This is a day when we remember sort of the great mistake. The great mistake of people waving palms for Jesus as he enters Jerusalem at the beginning of the last week of his life. Filled with maybe wrong-headed expectations, but hopeful and in solidarity with one another. It was the sound of liberation, I suppose. We blew the shofar this morning, which is the sound of Jubilee in Deuteronomy 25. The blowing of the shofar announces the year of Jubilee. Every 50 years, debts were to be forgiven. Land was to be returned to the people who were the original owners, who had needed to sell it because of financial difficulties during their generation. People who were in debtor's prison were to be released. Everyone was to be given a second chance. Every generation was to be given a second chance in the year of Jubilee. This hadn't happened for a long time. And so in Jesus' day, many people had been trapped in generational poverty. There had been no social reset. And so very few people owned most of the wealth of the land of Palestine, and people were living by day labor most of the time. If they were working fields, they were working as tenant farmers most of the time. So when they say, "Son of David, save us," they're picturing Jubilee, that day when all debts would be forgiven, as the Old Testament law had required, when land would be returned to the landless, when debtors in prison would be released, when every mountain would be brought low and every valley would be raised up, as is reminiscent of that very first portion of the book of Isaiah that Jesus reads in the synagogue in Nazareth. "Hope for the downtrod, Son of David, Jesus, save us," they say. And if one thing is clear in the Gospels, it's this, that none of the disciples really understood the radical nature of Jesus' vision until well after he had died. Was it time for the year of Jubilee? Well, yeah, absolutely. But the gospel stories give us every indication that what Jesus' followers and admirers were imagining was something like Jesus going into Jerusalem with a band of people as a counter display to the display of the parade of the Roman Empire, the imperial forces coming in on the other side of town, showing the force with which they used to exploit and oppress this conquered people. That Jesus coming in on his lowly donkey would raise up a peasant revolution, and perhaps there would be an overthrow of the system that had kept them in poverty for so long. But Jesus was resolutely nonviolent. In that encounter in the garden, we remember that when the soldiers come and one of the disciples draws a sword, Jesus says, "Put the swords back into your sheaths, for those who live by the sword will die by the sword." This injustice will not be solved by violence, he insists. You can create a temporary justice by using violence, but it will simply be a lull in the violence that will remain the norm. Violence is not a long-term solution to injustice. Even so, they perhaps imagined, after Jesus was taken captive by the Romans later on after that incident in the garden, that if anything were to really threaten Jesus, God would simply intervene somehow miraculously, and there'd be a divine cleanup of the world. And Jesus hangs on the cross, and maybe they were waiting for that to happen, and nothing happened. According to the Gospels, that doesn't appear, their thinking doesn't appear to be what Jesus thought. And they just didn't get it. And that's why the text has Jesus saying, as Jesus approached the city, he cried with tears of sadness, saying, "If you, Jerusalem, had only recognized the things that made for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes." Jesus knew that what makes for peace isn't necessarily the violent overthrow of a regime, but was the restoration of right relationships between people and others, between people and wealth, between people and their work, between people and their inner selves, between people and their God. He knew that peace comes from the restoration of economic right relationships and interpersonal right relationships and spiritual right relationships, and that restoration can't be built by means of violence, because violence always, in one way or another, blocks right relationship. And he knew that getting to shalom was not going to be as simple as regime change. This became amazingly clear 40 years later when another person marched into Jerusalem called Menachem of Galilee with followers who were zealots and tried to start a violent overthrow of the government, which resulted in massive Roman retaliation, legions of Roman soldiers coming in from Syria to crush that city and pull every block of the temple apart, block by block. 100,000 people were dead. Every person of the lineage of the Davidic line was searched out, hunted out, and killed, man, woman, and child. He knew that something else had to change. Thinking had to change. Expectations had to change. The limits of people's imaginations as to how the world could actually be had to change. Culture had to change. Hearts had to change. But the people waving the palms that day didn't quite get it, did they? They thought it was going to be much easier than that. For them, the suffering servant was Israel. It would turn out to be Jesus. And even so, and this is what we remember today, even so, they were with him on the way. They didn't understand him perfectly. They didn't understand the world perfectly. They couldn't really envision the scope of the reformation that he called for. They wanted something of a quick fix, and he wanted something of a cosmic fix. They didn't really understand his good news completely, and they were still thinking kind of dualistically, setting up an us and a them, and they wanted the us to sort of beat the them. They were good folks, wanting what was right, regular folks trying to get by, and they knew the situation they lived in was toxic, and they were a mixed bag of people. Think about even the 12 disciples who were faithfully there with Jesus along the way, except for that one. Peter, you know, the boisterous one who was going to jump out of the boat and walk on the water, and then whoop, he slips. Or the one who says, I will never deny you, and then ends up denying Jesus three times before he dies. But then becomes the rock of the church, the pillar upon which the church is built, and the one who gives his life for proclaiming Jesus as Messiah just 50 days after Jesus has died. James, one of the sons of thunder, known for strong opinions and his willingness to share them with others, probably, whether they wanted to hear them or not. You know, maybe the J in the group. There's John, the beloved disciple, who saw Jesus not only as a dear friend, but as cosmic companion. Mark, the misanthrope, who thinks people can never quite get it right, sees ignorance everywhere he looks. He's probably a J on the Myers-Briggs type, somebody you probably wouldn't want to be seated next to at a dinner party. He might not have been good fun. Mary and Martha, two people who wanted to serve Jesus and be with Jesus in different kinds of ways, probably patrons of Jesus. One who attended to the details and got things done, and another who simply wanted to be there for Jesus' spirit, making sure he felt honored and appreciated. You had Matthew, the tax collector over there, who, unlike John, saw Jesus as something like a second Moses, not really as cosmic Christ. Simon the fighter, who used to be a zealot, probably was really hoping for an overthrow on that day when he was marching into Jerusalem. And who could forget Judas? It wasn't a, when we see the 12 disciples at the Last Supper, the picture, we sort of sometimes see them as a group of superheroes, you know, they're all on the same page. Nope, that wasn't the case. They weren't on the same page. They're different. They were a group of kind of misfits, when you think about it, all gathered around Jesus for different reasons, but sharing his understanding that the world was broken and sharing his hopefulness about a future, but not really on the same page. And I think it's really interesting. Someone told me, I think it was a former pastor who was visiting, he said, look at the top of this church and count the number of turrets. There are 13. He said, I heard at one time from a former member that there was 13 because of the 12 apostles plus Paul. But I wonder if it's 13 because of the 12 apostles plus Matthias, to make sure that we count Judas in there, because there's always a Judas in the group. We're a group of people that's diverse, with all sorts of different ideas about things. But we're more or less for each other on the way. This crowd and the parade includes people who are poor and people who are mindfully rich, people who are weak in body and weak in spirit, people with abilities and disabilities, people who had a home in the social system and people who had been shunted outside. In this crowd, they found a home. They were bound together in their hopefulness, and in some sense, they were held together precisely because they were misfits together in their hopefulness, precisely because they couldn't, for whatever reason, accommodate the status quo. And so, as I think about this, I think, isn't that the case all the time? Aren't we always just a group of misfits trying to figure it out with each other? Nobody really completely understanding the full story, but each trying, bound by a spirit of common understanding about the brokenness of the world and the hopefulness that we share about the future, the hopefulness of peace coming someday, right relationship coming someday, of being here for each other. And don't we actually like it that we're not all the same and that we're kind of a band of misfits? Sometimes we look at ourselves and we think, wow, I'm not exactly put together. I'm not put together enough for that group. Guess what? Nobody's put together enough for that group. There's not a single fossil that's put together enough for that group. There's a little soft spot in each one of those personalities, which makes us feel close, because we see in their soft spots our own soft spots, don't we? We see in their failures and flaws and varieties of personalities our own failures and flaws and varieties of personalities. And what's interesting to me is that even though they couldn't see the world perfectly and they couldn't necessarily get the whole picture, it's these group of people who stayed together during the dark night of Jesus' death, who stayed together during those days until Pentecost, the 50 days until Pentecost, who thought about things together and worked through the problem of Jesus' absence and then apparent presence again together. It was this group of people who became and still are the very body of Christ, a misfit band. Think about the people who have really been a help to you along your way. Are they perfect people? When I think about the people who have been a real help to me along my way, I realize they're not perfect people. Everyone has some kind of a funny little thing about them that both kind of makes me go, ugh, and kind of makes me think, great, they're a human being just like me. I want us to give thanks today, not for a perfect world or a perfect church where we understand everything that's going on, but to give thanks for the band of misfits that is the body of Christ, that keeps together the vision of peace that pulls us into a better future. So I'm going to have Adrienne and our volunteers pass out some little cards today. They're thank you cards. Think in your mind about a person who is a misfit along your way, who has been in some way or another a help to you. And I want to encourage you to think about just writing a little thank you to them. It doesn't have to be now, but think for a minute as the choir is singing our song today about the importance of the quirky, lovely, imperfect people in our lives that buoy us up as we move forward into the future. Think about that. Maybe write a little bit about it, but I encourage you sometime this week to send that little letter just to say thank you for being you and for helping me along my way.